East and West Germany. Under the sponsorship of the American Society for the Study of the German Democratic Republic. It's going to be held June 2nd and 3rd at the Church Center of the United Nations, 1st Avenue and 44th Street, 777 United Nations Plaza. The Saturday morning and afternoon sessions include two on U.S.-East German economic relations with such able speakers as the economists Lynn Turgeon and Carl Niebel, and the prominent attorney Isidore Needleman. The address again is the Church Center of the United Nations, 1st Avenue and 44th Street, 777 United Nations Plaza, and the dates June 2nd and 3rd, a Friday and Saturday. Thank you very much.
Economic Perspective is a program of opinion independently produced for WBAI by Victor Perlo and presented on recording.
Good evening. This is Margot Adler with the Monday Night War Summary. Street fighting in Khon Tum continued for the fifth successive day. North Vietnamese and NLF troops entered three districts of Khon Tum today, to the north, to the south, and around the airfield. After bitter hand-to-hand and house-to-house combat with U.S. and Saigon bombers overhead, anti-government troops remained firmly entrenched in several sectors and showed no signs of weakening. Losses on both sides were heavy. A Saigon spokesman reported 168 anti-government forces and 20 Saigon forces killed in yesterday's fighting. As fighting continued, all U.S. advisors considered non-essential were flown out to Plai Khu. Military sources told AFP that they saw a failure of the North Vietnamese to spread their areas of control to the rest of Khon Tum, and they regarded this as encouraging. They said that barring a really major attack, the city would remain in government hands, although much of it would be destroyed in the process. Today, B-52 bombers attacked anti-government positions to the north and east of the city in blanket bombing raids. U.S. Hercules and Chinook helicopter transports continued flights into Khon Tum to carry in supplies and evacuate the wounded. The transports, however, were coming under increasingly heavy ground fire. On the northern front, fighting continued in the hills west of Hue. A Saigon spokesman said that North Vietnamese troops lost 32 killed when they attacked a government position near Firebase King, which is 24 miles from the city. Highway 13 continued to be a battleground as Saigon troops fought to relieve the town of An Lac. After 51 days, both sides appear to be showing signs of exhaustion. The U.S. command announced today that B-52 bombers dropped more than 1,000 tons of bombs on anti-government positions around Khon Tum during the night. 13 waves of bombers attacked positions inside a radius from 1 to 10 miles north, northwest, and west of the provincial capital. B-52 bombers also made 6 raids during the night in the northern provinces of Quang Tri, Tua Tien, and Quang Nam. The U.S. command also said that U.S. Phantom fighter bombers destroyed 2 more key rail and road bridges in North Vietnam. It said the bridges were situated 70 miles north of the demilitarized zone at Cho Phong and Ngoc Lam, and that a third bridge was damaged, a pontoon bridge and 2 ferries destroyed, in the same area during the raids. A 7th Air Force spokesman said that maximum emphasis was now being placed on the destruction of North Vietnam's railway network. The spokesman said the cutting of the southbound railway line linking Hanoi and Haiphong with the demilitarized zone was imposing severe strain on the system as it forced North Vietnamese to rely on thousands of trucks to carry war material, which could have been carried out by just one train had the railway been functioning. The command said that Air Force, Navy, and Marine tactical fighter bombers flew more than 280 strikes, sorties, against the north between Saturday and Sunday night. The command said that a raid on a military complex west of Vinh City destroyed 10 buildings and set off numerous fires. AFP correspondent Joel Henry reports from Hanoi that the North Vietnamese capital awoke again today to the sound of MiG fighters taking off as sirens wailed a pre-alert, indicating U.S. planes only 32 miles away. The warnings have been coming twice or three times daily, and Henry writes that they have caused speculation among foreigners that the capital may soon be bombed. Every 24 hours, the North Vietnamese Foreign Ministry's press department issues a statement denouncing the previous day's bombings, usually in identical terms and without giving details. In reply to persistent questions, the Vietnamese usually answer, secrecy is necessary in wartime. Henri writes that whether one can hear the bombings depends on wind direction as well as the nearness of the raid. Yesterday, for example, the bombings could not be heard, although the U.S. command announced bombings only 18 miles from the capital. Today, the bombings seemed to be falling not far from Hanoi, although they were 32 miles away. The AFP correspondent said that most Vietnamese believe, as they continue the evacuation of Hanoi, that heavy bombing will come around the end of this week, when the president has ended his visit to Poland. Meanwhile, the official party newspaper Nhan Dan today called for increased agricultural production and the mobilization of all available resources, quote, to meet the urgent needs of the revolution. The editorial said, quote, the revolution is passing through a phase where all the people are concentrating all of their efforts to vanquish the American aggressor. Agriculture must also mobilize in response to the people's and the armed forces' pressing need for food. Continued the editorial, quote, every inch of land must produce, every sort of food plant must be rationally exploited. The most immediate concern expressed in the editorial was the 5th month rice harvest and the preparation of the 10th month harvest. Continued the editorial, quote, the destructive air war is posing certain difficulties, but the people with the sense of determination is set on surmounting them to meet the situation and produce in all intended areas. Those reports from Joel Henri, the French press agency's correspondent in Hanoi. A Saigon court jailed 3 newspaper editors today for contravening the government's press laws. The official Vietnam press agency reported today that one editor of a monthly review had been imprisoned for 6 months with a fine of $500. One editor of a daily named Cu Noc or Save the Country had been imprisoned for 1 month with a $1,250 fine. And the editor of another daily was jailed for 1 month. Altogether, $5,750 in fines were imposed in 20 cases. 10 others accused were acquitted. 2 of the jailed editors were accused of harming national security or glorifying communism or neutralism. The paper, Cu Noc, was closed for a month. The 3rd editor was jailed for encouraging immorality, apparently a lesser offense. AFP correspondent Pierre Comparé reports from Peking that a usually well-informed diplomatic source told him that 3 Polish ships bound with cargo for Haiphong have unloaded at a Chinese port under an agreement worked out between the Chinese and Polish governments. Following the U.S. mining of Haiphong Harbor, the Polish and Chinese governments made contacts with a view to freight being unloaded in China and taken by rail to Vietnam. The Chinese government agreed to Poland's request, and qualified sources told Comparé they believe the South Chinese port involved is Gangkiang, which is 300 miles from Haiphong. Anti-government forces wounded 50 Cambodian government troops in a day-long battle yesterday 3 miles east of Siem Reap. A government spokesman conceded that the situation had slightly worsened for the government over the last 24 hours. Meanwhile, a high command spokesman said today that anti-government forces maintained several harassing attacks during the past 48 hours on the town of Sui Rieng. The spokesman said that at least 11 anti-government troops were killed in fighting yesterday east and northeast of the town, which is 75 miles southeast of the capital. Meanwhile, Cambodian Prince Norodom Sihanouk, presently living in Peking, returned there today after an 8-week journey in Korea and northeast China. He was greeted by several thousand people in Peking, including dancing troops, at Peking's central station. Sihanouk is expected to remain in Peking for only a short while and then to make another journey during June, which will take him to Romania, Albania, Algeria, Mauritania, and Yugoslavia. Finally, military sources in Vientiane said today that Pathet Lao and North Vietnamese forces entrenched in the southern Laotian town of Kongsodon have halted government attempts to dislodge them. Government troops advancing toward the town along Highway 13 from Paksay were halted and lost several dead in an encounter with anti-government forces. Yesterday, north of Kongsodon, forces recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency also failed to make any progress after being taken by helicopter into a position 2 miles away on Friday. U.S. and Laotian government military circles said that it is thought that anti-government forces may now make an attack against Paksay. This goes contrary to earlier theories by military circles that anti-government forces did not plan much action in this part of Laos. And that's the Monday Night War Summary. This is Margo Adler reporting.
The war summary was recorded a few hours ago. This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York at 99.5 FM. Upstairs.
TBAI is an urgent. Next, Perspective with Victor Perlo, another program of opinion independently produced for WBAI.
This is Victor Perlo. How do I size up the results of the Moscow summit meeting? Well, I'm not shouting for joy, nor am I crying with dismay. On the whole, I see it as positive. The fact of the meeting, the nature of the agreements reached, are a reflection of the new world relation of forces. That relationship in which the forces of socialism are at least as strong as the forces of capitalism, and the leaders of the world's most powerful capitalist state are compelled to recognize this. Perhaps the most significant sentence in the Declaration of Principles is the statement that the two countries, quote, will proceed from the common determination that in the nuclear age there is no alternative to conducting their mutual relations on the basis of peaceful coexistence. Differences in ideology and in the social systems of the USA and the USSR are not obstacles to the bilateral development of normal relations based on the principles of sovereignty, equality, non-interference in internal affairs, and mutual advantage, end of quote. The principle of peaceful coexistence of socialist and capitalist countries has been fought for by Soviet leaders and communists generally since the time of Lenin. Until fairly recently, it was opposed as some sort of communist plot by leaders of the United States and other imperialist states. The same coexistence principle was affirmed in the Nixon-Zhou Enlai meetings. The Moscow meeting and its agreements involved certain steps consistent with this principle. They moved in the direction of normalization of state relations between the United States and the Soviet Union. Owing to the ever-present aim of imperialists to look for an opportunity to weaken and destroy socialist states, relations between the United States and the USSR have remained and continue to be abnormal. To official America, the Soviet Union has been regarded as something of a pariah state. But following the Nixon visit and these agreements, it will be difficult for Washington to maintain the various discriminations and hostile procedures towards the Soviet Union in the area of trade, travel, and even military affairs. By virtue of the tendency to normalize relations, the summit meeting represents a further deterioration of the Cold War policies, a further demonstration of their bankruptcy. Finally, it was made clear that the Soviet Union was not in any degree cutting back its support to national liberation movements. This was not only implicit in the general formulations, but sharply put in the Soviet statement on Indochina in the joint communique, to wit, and I quote, "The Soviet side stressed its solidarity with the just struggle of the peoples of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia for their freedom, independence, and social progress," end of quote. The statement went on to give complete support to the North Vietnamese and NLF programs and to demand the end of all U.S. military actions there. However, the flow of agreements reached in Moscow did not represent real breakthroughs in most areas. The nearest to it, the SALT agreement, is but a step towards checking the arms race. As Defense Secretary Laird was quick to point out, it doesn't change his intention to further step up the arms budget. Its positive content lies partly in making clear to anti-communist hotheads that the dream of building up a superiority of forces with which to destroy socialism is a suicidal fantasy. There is no change in the U.S. policy of aggression, as expressed most viciously in Indochina, and there is no immediate change in the area of trade. The basic discrimination by the U.S. government, the form of economic warfare against the Soviet Union, remains intact. No credits, no scrapping of the export embargo list, no ending of the discriminatory high tariffs. Not even the realization of accords previously agreed to in general for the admission of Soviet merchant vessels without discrimination to U.S. ports. As I indicated in my previous broadcast, Nixon has been resisting pressure from U.S. business interests to open up trade with the Soviet Union, partly because of his intense anti-communism and traditional opposition to such trade, partly because of the stubborn idea that he could get the Soviet Union to help him subdue Vietnam in exchange for trade. It's clear that there were no such deals and could not be. A joint U.S.-Soviet commission to try to work out trade arrangements has been set up. It will meet semi-annually with the first meeting in July in Moscow. A similar Soviet-Japanese commission has been operating for several years, and it has contributed to the rather rapid growth of Soviet-Japanese trade, but hasn't prevented long delays in conclusion of projected major deals, nor ended completely Japanese subservience to U.S.-inspired Cold War economic policies. The pressures within the United States for opening up this trade are sufficient to make likely some results and a continued gradual growth in U.S.-Soviet trade. But the Nixon administration has brought to the fore a new roadblock to a major advance, the lend-lease issue. The U.S. demand for payment of $800 million on so-called lend-lease debts is blackmail, pure and simple. The Soviet Union contributed most in blood and wealth to the joint struggle against the Axis powers in World War II. In exchange for the relatively small material contribution of the United States, it saved the U.S., Britain, and other countries tens of millions of casualties and the danger of conquest by fascist Germany. Other countries receiving lend-lease from the U.S. not only weren't required to pay for it, but were given huge supplemental restoration aid after World War II. The Soviet Union has already made payments to the United States under an earlier agreement for certain civilian-type lend-lease supplies. The U.S. not only demanded payment from the USSR, but instead of helping this most war-damaged country of all, immediately launched economic warfare against it. To continue to demand payment is an obscenity in the light of this history. The Soviet Union, many years ago, offered $300 million to settle a claim. Regardless of principle, they evidently considered it worth paying in order to get the benefits they expected from trade with the United States. I do not know what their attitude is now. They are much stronger economically and perhaps less willing to pay a tribute for the removal of U.S. trade discriminations. Some liberals interpret the peaceful tone of Nixon's speeches in Moscow as signs of a new Nixon, but there is no new Nixon. There is simply the needed recognition by U.S. monopoly capital of the changed balance of forces in the world. And there is a less crude style of expression, which Nixon has learned from his TV advertising trainers. But it is the same old Nixon. Does a visit to Moscow help Nixon's election campaign? Yes. But in my opinion, that help will be short-lived. Realities will assert themselves. Simultaneously with the ending of the visit, the Nixon administration introduced a measure for changing the name of the SACB and broadening its scope of action. It's a typical maneuver to consolidate his right wing by increasing repression at home to counterbalance what is in effect a retreat in international relations. Nixon's racism, his anti-labor policies, his pro-big business budget and tax policies, his continued aggressive foreign policy, especially in Indochina, will largely wipe out the advantage he gains from this visit long before the election, including the Polish votes he hopes to gain from his campaign trip to Warsaw. At the same time, the visit should be used by progressives as a special means of exposing Nixon. Exposing the contrast between his words and his deeds, such as his crocodile tears for the children starved by the Nazi blockade in Leningrad while he is murdering the children of Vietnam, And the agreements provide handles for important concrete struggles in the United States. The SALT agreement provides a major tool for anybody who seriously wants to fight the super expensive military budget. Starting with McGovern supporters, who can use it as a basis for his proposed cuts, which would still leave the U.S. military budget 2.5 times the Soviet military budget. The setting up of a trade commission provides a basis for mobilizing large numbers of workers, businessmen, etc., to seriously campaign for taking away the barriers which are preventing billions in business and hundreds of thousands of industrial jobs in the United States. In this connection, I want to refer to a question frequently raised when I give talks. That is, trade with socialist countries supposedly strengthens capitalism and hence weakens the revolutionary movement in the capitalist countries. So the Soviet Union is doing a disservice to or betraying the workers of the capitalist countries by trading with them. Here is my answer to this question. Trade is a two-way affair that benefits both sides, or else it wouldn't take place except under duress or domination of one country by another. However, a socialist country gains more than a capitalist country because of the advantage of central overall planning, which makes possible a relatively accurate calculation of overall net national advantage from a given pattern of trade. Whereas trade of a capitalist country is a resultant of individual profit drives of particular capitalists and corporations and may not contribute in a highly effective way to overall economic efficiency.
WBAI, New York.
Moreover, foreign trade under capitalism cannot eliminate the internal contradictions that ultimately lead to depressions. Trade with socialist countries is of advantage to workers in capitalist countries politically because the strengthening of socialist countries is to the advantage of the international working class, and economically, because it does provide additional employment. Unquestionably, it is very important for workers in the machinery and electronic and computer industries in the United States today. Will getting jobs through that trade make the workers less revolutionary? Well, they aren't very revolutionary anyhow. It is like any reform. It is a two-sided affair. When workers win any struggle, there is a tendency to relax and say, well, things aren't so bad now, and to drop their vigilance. On the other hand, the victorious struggle, if it's conducted correctly, gives a sense of power, and with proper leadership can lead to building a more militant organization striving for more advanced goals. All successful revolutionary leaders, from Karl Marx on, have stressed the necessity of struggle for reforms as an absolute essential component of the building of a revolutionary people's organization. Marxists have always rejected the puerile notion of the worse the better, which is implied in the attacks on East-West trade. What is lacking in the United States is an adequate labor and people struggle for East-West trade, instead of the present situation where big business is carrying the ball. The less labor participates in the fight for East-West trade, the less American workers will get out of it as it develops. The more freedom the companies will have to fill their orders from European factories, and so on. The U.S. Communist delegation to Vietnam this April, headed by Gus Hall, had longer and more exhaustive conversations with the top Vietnamese political leadership than any other U.S. delegation. But the Daily Press virtually killed their report, although the journalists covered it at the two press conferences that were held. One feature of their report is relevant to the Nixon visit to Moscow. There is an idea insidiously cultivated by Washington and assiduously by anti-Soviet elements on the left that the USSR sold out Vietnam by hosting Nixon. Only time will tell whether the USSR leadership made a wise decision to let Nixon come. But on the specific issue of the effect on Vietnam, there is no doubt whatsoever. The Soviet Union did not retreat one iota from its commitment to Vietnam, nor adjust its tactics one iota to accommodate Nixon's visit. The Vietnamese political leadership assured Hall and his colleagues that they have had absolute cooperation, everything they ever wanted or asked for from the Soviet Union, and that they have absolute confidence that this was continuing and would continue. Hall confirmed that impression in his conversations in Moscow on the way home. At the same time, the Soviet Union tries to conduct its aid to national liberation movements in such a manner as to avoid, if at all possible, a thermonuclear war. I.F. Stone, writing in the New York Review, praises them for this, but implicitly criticizes them for what he seems to consider their betrayal of Vietnam by not militarily opposing the mining of Haiphong Harbor. Well, he can't have it both ways. I think history will show that Vietnam will win despite the mining crisis, that there was no betrayal. Just as history showed that Cuba won despite the missile crisis of 1962 and that there was no betrayal then. Progressives in the United States needn't worry about the role of the Soviet Union in relation to Indochina. We have to worry rather about our own role, our own failure as yet to stop Nixon's re-escalation of the war, our own failure to put some starch in the flabby opposition of Congress and the Senate, worry about adding much greater participation in the coming Labor Peace Conference in St. Louis, June 23 to 24, worry about doing everything to ensure the election of an anti-war president in Congress and in dumping Nixon, Humphrey, and Wallace decisively and finally. Thank you very much.
That was Perspective with Victor Perlo, a program of opinion independently produced for WBAI and presented on recording. This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York at 99.5 FM.